Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew LeClaire. This is Equal Time for Free Thought, the humanistic show that brings rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism to the public in the hopes of fostering positive social change. My guest today is Professor Gary Wills. Wills has written around 40 books on politics, religion, and specifically the Catholic Church. His latest book is The Future of the Catholic Church with Pope Francis. A lifelong Catholic himself, Wills has expressed his interest in seeing positive social change in the Church, ranging from the acceptance of other religions to accepting the removal of the confessional, the priesthood, and the papacy claiming to have a direct line with God. Wills has received myriad awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Pulitzer Prize, and the National Medal for the Humanities. There's so much to say about Professor Wills' career, but our time, as always, is limited. So, let's play the interview. So can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to write this book on the future of the Catholic Church and talk mostly about the past?
Well, because the myth is that the Church is changeless. And my realization was that the Pope would be challenged to prevent change, because that for some people has been the job of the Pope. To be there to make sure that it has always been right in every way, and it doesn't have to do anything else but what it has been doing for all this long time. And that's historically false, and it's theologically untrue to the gospel. Jesus didn't come to set up a changeless empire. And this Pope, when I first began to be aware of him, is one who doesn't want the trappings of empire. He doesn't want to remind us of hierarchical figures, mitered, crozier, costumed. He wants to remind us of Jesus. That used to be the job of Protestants, but that's a false distinction between two branches of Christianity, which should not be rivals or enemies or different, but should both be trying to follow Jesus as best they can.
Right. And I suppose that the question for me and for a lot of people looking at a good deal of the body of your religious works and your studying of church history is that you have remained a Catholic as opposed to just referring to yourself as a Christian. So can you tell us a little bit about your personal history and what drew you to studying, in particular, the Catholic Church?
Sure. Well, my whole experience of being a Christian has been Catholic, and the people who I admired, tried to imitate and learn from, whether they were nuns or priests or lay scholars or lay ordinary people, were Catholic. That doesn't mean that I couldn't have found similar guidance elsewhere. But if I were to say I have to leave the Catholic Church to be a Christian, that would be saying that there is a difference between the bodies of Christianity, which exclude each other. And I don't think there should be. In the Gospel of Luke, the first time Jesus sends his followers out on their own, when they come back, he asks them, how did it go? And John, the apostle, not the evangelist, says, it went very well. And we were casting out devils. But he said, we came across one person who was also casting out devils in your name, but he wasn't one of us. And so we told him to stop. And Jesus says, why did you say that? If he's doing it in my name, he's not against me. But we have had centuries and centuries of history in which we told other Christians, stop. You don't own Christ. We do.
Right.
That's what I'm opposed to, and that doesn't make me not a Catholic, doesn't make me not a Protestant. When I've met various people, they've said, well, you sound just like a Protestant. I said, guilty, guilty. You got me.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that the difficulty that a lot of people have in understanding that is just that when we think in general of the Catholic Church, we think about the things that are done at a Catholic Church. For example, confessing sins or transubstantiation or, you know, those types of things. And so when you've spoken out against those things, it just strikes people as confusing that you remain as a Catholic rather than just saying, well, maybe this church as it stands now isn't quite for me.
Well, you know, transubstantiation and confession came into the church before the Reformation, so it was a kind of diversion from the gospel before there were Catholics or Protestants. And all I say is that they are things that are not explicit in the gospel, and there's no reason to think they are implicit. Transubstantiation, for instance, is a very late addition to what people thought about the Eucharist. The idea that Jesus was talking literally, that this piece of bread I'm giving you is my body, was clearly not his body, because the thing that was handing it to them was his body.
Right.
And they couldn't eat him while he was handing them this symbol. So it's absurd. The reason why it was accepted out of a fundamentalist thing, if he says it's my body, it's my body, you know, that kind of fundamentalist approach to texts of all sorts, whether religious or otherwise, is an historical accident. And we don't have to live with that. St. Augustine in the 4th and 5th centuries said, he told us what his body was. He said, you are the wheat, you are formed together into one bread. The body of Jesus is you. He said, when the bread lies on the altar, you look at it, it's you. It's you as his body, his mystical body. And when he gave out communion, he would say, receive what you are, the body of Christ. So you don't have to go back to be either a Catholic or a Protestant to see that's what was meant originally. And for various historical reasons, we have veered off in other directions from what seems to me kind of the obvious reading of the gospel.
Well, I definitely want to get more into talking about this this study of religion and the Catholic Church, but I also just want to touch on a little bit of your work in politics and your writings on politics. And so I know that you're very well known, not only for this work on the Catholic Church, but also on American politics. And you started off as a conservative, but became increasingly liberal over time. So what led you to be a conservative at that time? And what then led you to make such a dramatic change later on?
Well, I was invited, when I submitted an article on Time magazine to National Review, I was invited by Bill Buckley, the editor, to come talk to him in New York, and I did. And he said, are you a conservative? And I said, is a distributist a conservative? And he said, no, I'm afraid it's not. Distributism was, he knew about that because he had good friends who were editors of Commonweal, and he had asked them, do you count distributism as Catholic? And they said, no. Distributism was a British force in Edwardian England. Chesterton and Belloc were the most famous distributists, and their whole point was they were anti-capitalists, and that's why Bill said, no, they're not conservatives, because he thought capitalism and conservatism were the same thing. But they said they were not capitalists. They were not against private property, so they were not socialists either. but they felt that private property should be more distributed. It should not be concentrated in monopolies in what today we call the 1%. So they had various not very realistic ways to try to distribute property more evenly. They involved anti-capitalist movements like rural life, smaller peasant holdings, that kind of thing. So it was not a very realistic view, but it was not so far from what somebody like Bernie Sanders is now saying against the 1%. But nonetheless, that was the kind of conservatism I went to National Review with. And of course, I was very anti-communist, as all Catholics were at the time. We used to pray every Mass for the conversion of Russia. But as I wrote more for National Review and I got to be aware of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement during Vietnam, it became clear that we didn't agree much. And so at what was the breaking point was that I submitted an article to Bill saying there's absolutely no conservative reason to support the Vietnam War. It's not really effectively anti-communist. It offends most of our allies around the world. We're not going to win anyway.
I could see how this possibly turned bad.
And he said, well, I can't run it. He said it would be too offensive to my readers. Wow. So we parted ways for 30 or so years. And finally, his sister, Priscilla, who is a wonderful person and had been our friend, my wife's and my friend for all those years, said, it's kind of crazy that you guys who were friends once, I used to sail with them a lot, have never talked to each other for a long time. So we got back together shortly before, well, 2 years before he died. And he told me during that reconciliation period that he gave my book on Jesus, What Jesus Meant, as a Christmas present to his relatives. So we ended up friends again. And by the way, he changed a lot in that interval. He opposed the Iraq War, for instance. And his son voted for Obama because he realized his father had changed so much.
I just wonder, in terms of your analysis, both looking at politics and looking at religion, if ever in your life you have certain methods or ways of addressing topics of politics and religion, are the methods the same or are they different for each category?
I don't know. I don't know. I probably don't think very methodologically. The people who interested me in terms of politics were mainly realists of a broadly conservative sort, Samuel Johnson or Edmund Burke or William Cobbett or Chesterton or Belloc. They tended to think less in terms of political parties, which didn't exist in many of their early lives, but of human needs, how the state is supposed to serve human needs. When I was first working for Bill, Frank Meyer wanted to put together an anthology of conservative essays, and I wrote one called The Convenience State, that the role of government is to do things for people that they can't do individually or even on a family or local community basis. And that was counted conservative enough to get into that anthology, but a lot of people have read it since as being very liberal. Well, could be. I guess you can read it either way.
Well, I suppose that in the transition of the Republican Party as we know it, it's certainly very different from what it was back in the 60s and 70s. At least I would suggest it is. And I think there's no better example of that than what we're seeing right now in the Republican Party with the rise of Donald Trump. And I know that you've written a little bit about him, but our last show touched on this subject. But can you tell us a little bit about your feelings in that regard, and how does Donald Trump represent the Republican Party of the past?
Well, I just did a review not long ago of E.J. Dionne's new book, which argues that Trump is not anything new. If you go back and read The Conscience of a Conservative in 1964, which was written by Bill Buckley's brother-in-law, Brent Pizzell, it's essentially the Tea Party. It was hate government. It was keep government off my life, out of my life. And it was pretty blatantly racist. It appealed to the South. Now, Barry Goldwater in 1964, whose book that was, Conscience of a Conservative, ran a disastrous presidential campaign, which was very successful in one way. He got the whole South finally behind the Republicans instead of the Democrats, right, who had been their ancestral party. And it has been that ever since. So America's great original sin is its anti-black racism. Not racism in general, specifically anti-black. Both my families were from the South, and I knew this close up. And that's not something that's shed easily or at all. And people thought of Trump as a kind of joke because way back, you know what, now, 10 years, he started saying Obama is not an American president.
Yes.
He's not an American.
Yes.
And he has never renounced that. You know, you can't, you the birth certificate was released, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody thought, well, this is just a quirk on his part. But when you look at his followers, they're still saying, 60% of Trump followers are still saying, he's not one of us. He's not an American. He's a Muslim.
Right.
He's a Kenyan. That was the basis of his appeal from the outset. And people who say, oh, it's the discontent of the middle class, etc., nonsense. They're just not facing the obvious that there is still a well, let me put it this way. Many people, including me, were very hopeful that we had made a step forward when we elected a black man as president of the United States. But you'll notice that after that election, the great amount of anti-black sentiment and activity and backlash has grown immensely. And there's no reason to suspect the cause of that. It's because to many people, well, let me put it this way. I had my grandmother from Atlanta, where I was born, was a wonderful Irish Catholic woman, full of charity, did all kinds of good works, etc. And once when I was a little kid, I went to Mass with her, and out onto the altar came a black priest, and she grabbed my hand and pulled me out of the church.
Wow.
And I said, what was that all about? And she said, that man cannot hold our Lord in his hands. And I said, well, you know, you have a wonderful woman who comes in and helps you bake all the time. She was a baker who's black, and she said, that's different.
Huh.
You can't have dignity. You know, the woman who helped her didn't have the dignity of the church. Well, that's not something that goes away fast.
Yeah.
If ever and if at all.
Yeah, and I suppose that when a person tries to understand the reasoning for that, it's difficult to understand unless you yourself grew up with it. Or at least that's my interpretation, coming from, you know, being born in the very early 1990s, growing up in New Jersey, and then going to college in New York City. For me, it doesn't make any sense. So I wonder if it's just if there's a clearer understanding that you have, having had that kind of experience, and it sounds like maybe you do.
Yeah, and, you know, my other side of the family was from Virginia. They had a less degree of racism. But I saw it sorted out as people grew up, in my aunts and my aunts and myself and my sister, that we had a northern experience that made us realize that this racism was totally illogical. But, you know, I had, until they died, a number of very close relatives who were extremely racist.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about the church again, and about religion and those issues. So one of the biggest things that you have advocated for, I think, during a large portion of your career is change. And what I'm interested in is not so much the specific changes that you want to see, but more what types of changes you want to see. In other words, are they changes in the espoused beliefs of the church, or just changes in the rituals and the structure of the church?
Well, the ritual and the structure are probably resistant to change more than anything. Well, the doctrine, I should say, the dogma. You know, what Pope Francis has done is not challenge doctrine head on. He's just said, well, think of what Jesus would say.
You know, right.
Says, when people say, we don't want to change the ritual of, you know, he would say things like, the confessional is not a torture chamber, or the Eucharist is not a reward for good behavior. It's a food for the weak, for the sinners. And that is, by the way, that's exactly what Jesus said when the Pharisees said, this man eats with sinners. And Jesus said, well, I came to sinners to deal with them. So what has been brilliant about Francis is that he doesn't say, oh, let's sit down and argue transubstantiation.
Right.
He says, let's do what Jesus does. Let's go out and reach the poor. He said, you're supposed to be shepherds. What do you know about the sheep? You should know what the sheep smell like if you're a shepherd. Now, that has been so incredibly brilliant because the whole of the structure around him in the Vatican is a privileged bastion of resisting change. You know, these are people who all came up the ladder toward being Monsignors and then Cardinals, then members of the Curia, and they don't like any of the things he's doing, but it's very hard to get at him. He was very shrewd to move out of the palace into the guest house in the Vatican.
Yeah.
To stop wearing as much as he could of the fancy stuff, to be driven around in small cars, not big limousines. And it's hard for people to say, well, let's sit down and argue about transubstantiation. When you say, wait a minute, where are the poor? I'm trying to get at them. What are we going to do about them?
Yeah.
So, for instance, on climate change, you know, he issued an encyclical on that, Laudato Si, which is a wonderful quote from St. Francis, and said, I'm not going to argue the science. You know, that's there. We'll know something about it. But what is it doing to the third world? What is it doing to the worst parts, the most suffering parts of humanity? So that's his approach throughout. And by the way, he didn't arrive at this just by being so smart. He made bad mistakes when he was the provincial of the Jesuits, and then originally the Bishop of Buenos Aires. And he admits as much. It was a very difficult time. The dirty war was going on in his country. He had to protect when he was the provincial of the Jesuits. He knew that if they went into the slums to preach to the poor, they would probably be treated as communist agitators. And he tried to protect them. And in doing it, as he says, I didn't consult with people who would have helped me. I tried to do it on my own. And that mistake was so searing to him that now he's constantly saying, let's question, for instance, in these meetings of the bishops that he's had on the family, he says to the bishops before they come, find out what the faithful are saying. And when they come, before, they used to meet in secret and give a secret document to the Pope, and the Pope would do with it whatever he wanted. He has said, let's publish it all. He's trying to include everybody. And that was the way John the 23rd operated, who's his model, his first model. When he came in second in the election of Benedict XVI, he was the second in the voting. And afterward, people asked him, what would you have taken as a name if you had been elected? And he said, John the 24th, which told you exactly where he was in the lineup of the church at the time. But then he had 8 years or whatever to think it over, and he chose Francis. An astonishing choice, because Francis wasn't even a priest. He was a non-clerical figure. He was a brother, not even a superior of his order. So he was saying that he wanted to be one of the faithful. And to be accepted as that, and to lead as that, and to ask them what they actually live by. And, of course, that's the way change really comes about in the church. It's not so much a matter of doctrinal debate. For instance, there are all kinds of excesses of medieval monarchy that the church engaged in. Interdicts, for instance, where a pope would say, no one can have the sacraments in any realm that I'm arguing with politically. You know, that's a horrible thing.
That's right, yeah. And of course, yeah, go ahead.
It's never formally renounced. It's just everybody started ignoring it so widely. There was nothing you could do with it. Indulgences has been done. Confession's going that way, too. People are not going to confession anymore.
Yeah. And so the thing that I really wonder about that is, you know, in terms of the seven sacraments, I mean, what does it mean for the church when there are these seven sacraments? I guess first it would be good to tell us a little bit about what the seven sacraments are. And then second, what does it mean if they can change from time to time?
Well, they're a late development, too. And some people can receive. For instance, only the priest can receive holy orders. Others that other people can receive. Six are given out only by priests. Baptism, they couldn't distort the history that much. They had to admit other people can give baptism. But they're all late additions. The final rites, you know, holy extreme unction, only the dead people can receive. All of these have very slender, if at all, scriptural or historical bases. And more they are being ignored.
Right.
As I say, the penance, the confession is being ignored. Pretty much extreme unction is a kind of formality that people don't feel so necessary. But the Eucharist is one that you can continue to receive, as I do, but completely ignore the meaning foisted upon it, that it was literally the body of Jesus. It's us as a family getting together for the family meal. So all of these things can change in practice and have. John Henry Newman wrote on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine. And he was silenced by Rome for writing that. But he said that during the Arian controversy, the faithful in the West, at least, was more orthodox than the hierarchy. And, of course, the hierarchy didn't want to hear that, so they said, shut up. But, you know, that was one of the key things that I read when I was in college that made me realize that the church is not simply what the Pope says or the hierarchy says. It's what the followers of Jesus are trying to do. And some of us are Catholics and some aren't. But we're not against each other. We're all on the same team.
This is Matthew LeClaire, and you are listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. My guest today is Professor Gary Wills. And up until this point, Wills had discussed unity amongst us on issues of the poor, on climate change, or just on being a good person. Now, up until this point, he had discussed monotheistic religions, but I was trying to make the point that all of us, theists and non-theists alike, have shared values. So, for the first time, I brought up secular humanists.
Right. Well, and in terms of working towards the same goals, I suppose that in a way it seems as if it has a connection to not only all religions, but also non-theistic beliefs. For example, you know, many good people can join in together to, for example, help the poor or fight against climate change or do that those types of things. So I just wonder what it is that makes, if the seven sacraments go away and if all of the stories that are connected to it go away, what makes the Catholic Church or the Catholic religion different from, say, from a secular humanist?
Who cares? I shouldn't say
that
about secular humanists. I thought you were going to say what makes it different from other Christian sects. But it shouldn't make those difference. And when you say working for the poor, ecumenical religion has often started out on the missionary level. If people are in a foreign country and they're Catholics or Protestants or Jewish, then they, when they work together on obviously good projects to help people, their differences begin to fade. And so the history of ecumenical relations has often been something happening out on the margins. And I think that's why this Pope has said we should go out to the fringes, to the margins. That's where we really act like Jesus and realize that we're all in the same program. We're all trying to do the same thing.
Right. And if the end goals, I understand, can be the same, it's just the thing that I think so many people see in the world is that there's so many different religious beliefs. And within each one of those religious beliefs, there's thousands of divergences from the core. So, you know, we talked a little bit about religious fundamentalism. So, for example, some people believe in the story of Noah's Ark as being a literal thing. Other people don't. And it's complications like that that I suppose it becomes complicated to get a genuine understanding of what a religion is. For example, in the case of Catholicism, if it has no core differences with anything else.
Well, why do we have to have it? For instance, for terrible, hateful centuries, the church was anti-Semitic. You know, there were all kinds of ways to say it was not really anti-Jewish. It was just supersessionism. They had a good arrangement with God, but we came along and ours was better. So that one's no good anymore. It took the Second Vatican Council finally to say, that's nonsense. God made a deal with them. He doesn't go back on his deals. And we have to honor that. And now the church formally does. And there was nothing in the scripture that especially said that our covenant was better than theirs, except one crazy document, the letter to the Hebrews, ascribed to Paul, though it's not by him, clearly. That's the only one that said it. And for years, people said, oh, my God, we can't go against the scripture. But this pope is not only very ecumenical toward the Jews, but toward Muslims. He has said that the Quran is a great spiritual book. And, of course, we are all believers in the same God. There's only one, whether you call him Yahweh or Allah or Abba, as Jesus did. It's the same God. Why should we look for differences when we can find agreements that are very important for our love of each other, which is the main. Well, people say, Peter's the head of the church. He never was, but they say that, and that means he can boss people around. Jesus said, was he repenting of the fact that he had disowned him three times? Things in response. He said, do you love me? And he says, yes. Do you love me? Yes. You know I do. Yeah. Do you love me? That's core on medieval distinctions between matter and form. The core of every monotheistic religion is love.
Well, and I think that Pope Francis went even a step further at one point. I believe it was back in October of 2013, where he even talked about non-theists, saying that they would be forgiven by God so long as they obey their consciences and do good in the world. So, in other words, they too will be okay, even if they do not believe in a supreme being at all. How do you feel about that particular change that Pope Francis was calling upon?
Well, God made him. God made everybody. What does he think of them? He must love them. He must have wanted them to be. The Pope's attitude is always, what does God want us to do? Want us to despise people he made? One of the worst things, I think, in the Quran, that it's even more insisted on hell than Jews don't know much about. They don't know what's going to happen after death in an official way. But hell is a very hard thing to reconcile with the idea that there's a loving God. That came home to me when my son, when he was in grade school, was going to a Catholic school. And I don't know what he was, 10 or so. He was screaming at night one night. And I went into the bedroom and said, what's the matter? And he said, I said, why? And he said, well, the nuns taught us today about hell. And he said, I dreamt that I was in hell. He said, am I going to hell? And I said, well, I don't know. But if you go, I'm going with you. And if God doesn't say the same thing, I don't know what God is.
Yeah, and that's been a problem that I've certainly struggled with myself in my own attempt to sort of understand what's really out there, is that, you know, it doesn't make sense and it doesn't really match up for me personally. And I'm not sure if you could tell up to this point, but I definitely wouldn't identify myself as a Christian at this point in my life. And the difficulty for me has always been that, you know, there's a serious struggle in trying to interpret what to believe, what not to believe. And I think a good example is this, where the divinity of Jesus, for example, or perhaps the resurrection story, for me, coming from sort of a more secular observation, seems just as difficult or supernatural to imagine being true as is the story of Noah's Ark or water turning into wine or two of every animal fitting onto a boat. You know, so it's through your life, if there's any, how you manage to grapple with determining which one of these things doesn't make sense.
Well, a lot of it, I suppose, depends on your sense of mystery. How much you think everything means more than they seem to mean. That there is a fading off of what we know toward what seems... St. Augustine said, if it's God, you don't understand. It's not God.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, beyond which we in our knowledge. And one of the problems of a lot of religion is they think they can figure out things that God's not telling us yet. They have to know exactly who's going to heaven, who's going to hell, what this religion means, what its doctrines have to be. It's all neat. And, you know, that's why when I was in college, I was taught Thomas Aquinas's theology. And it all seemed to me too cut and dried, too neat. Everything was solved. Absolutely everything. And that's what made me like Augustine much more. He knew what he didn't know, and he encouraged us to do the same thing, which is a different attitude toward life in general, but toward religion in particular.
Right, and I think that it does make sense in the abstract sense, but in an attempt to try to really come to some sort of conclusion, not even to the point of being able to understand who goes to heaven and who goes to hell, but even the more basic question of, are these things even real in the first place? And it seems that for you, and that for, I would say, the majority of people on Earth throughout history, they believe in one form of it or another more often than not. It's just a matter of in what regard they believe it and to what extent. So again, I'm kind of trying to get at what your path has been to make these determinations about things like the existence of heaven and hell. When you talked about Noah's Ark, for example, you referred to that as kind of I don't think you used the word goofy, but you sort of had that feeling. But when it comes to things like the resurrection story, for you, that's not a you know, that's not subject to question. And I never want to be one of those people that that you talked about in your book, Why I Am a Catholic, where you were referring to some of the criticisms you were receiving from non-theists, where you said that it seems unlikely I will convince those who are sure that the Catholic Church cannot be taken seriously. And for me, I'm coming from the perspective that it can be taken seriously, but I don't know how to determine which claims to take seriously and which claims not to determine as serious, because to me, the method that I use to analyze it all just makes it fall apart. So I wonder what makes it stick together for you.
Well, on the resurrection, I'm fascinated by the Quran's doctrine on that, because that was a revolutionary thing in the 7th century Arab culture, to believe in the resurrection. And he started from analogies that things are constantly reborn and the seasons, etc., etc. In other words, there's a yearning for life beyond life. There are various expressions of that. The most convincing one that I have found myself is not the resurrection story in the Gospels, but the earlier resurrection story in Paul. That he met Jesus, the risen Jesus, and the other followers of Jesus didn't question that, but he doesn't know exactly what he met, and he says, we'll rise again, but there's no knowing what will be if we rise again. It will be something as different as a tree is from a seed. And that he argues this from his own experience. Now, I find that the most arresting and important statement of what the resurrection could be. As I say, I think they're all, you know, a lot of this is a matter of how seriously you take poetry and metaphors. They're all reaching toward a mysterious reality beyond us, and the one that I find most interesting is Paul's.
And in the case of Paul, I know that's certainly a main focus. And as I understand it, he was the earliest person to write about this story. Do I have that?
Absolutely.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the one thing that I wondered, and something that I try to apply with anything else that I read, is to find out whether or not there are others who replicate that story or who corroborate that story. So were there any other contemporaries of Paul that talked about any of this?
Yeah, of course there were people that challenged him, and he argues with them in the Corinthians. But what's fascinating is that nobody that we know of, reflected in his conflicts and his successes with other Christians, said, oh, no, you're not part of the Christian movement. You don't really know Jesus or any of that kind of thing. You know, he joined the community of the followers and worked with them, was successful with them, and none of them said, oh, you're just a weirdo. and he actually quotes earlier hymns, and he's the first one who says that Jesus said, this is my body.
Right.
He didn't mean it literally, but he was just quoting the community that he had joined. He didn't make this stuff up. He was part of an ongoing movement. And when he goes to Rome, you know, people think of him as setting up his own church. He joined the church that existed. When he went to Rome, he mentions dozens of people there who were already there before he went, who were Christians. So I find that a very gripping and interesting first way into the history of Christianity.
Right. And I suppose with Paul's writings, the question that keeps coming up for me is, well, I guess it's not a question, but it's more an analogy. I know that there are situations where people can say that they saw something or experienced something. Let's go for one of the most ridiculous claims. Donald Trump, I hate to bring him back, but Donald Trump, had said that he saw, thousands of Muslims cheering in New Jersey on 9/11. And there are still, despite obviously no evidence of this fact, there are still many people who believe that that is true. And so for me, I just wonder if I know this might be blasphemous to suggest in any respect that Paul is similar to Donald Trump, but what I more mean is that, without a corroborating source and just taking Paul's word on this subject, I'm not sure how that convinces not only a typical person, but somebody like you who is in large part a historian.
Well, you know, Paul doesn't stand alone. He is the first, and other people who come after come some decades after, but they're also drawing on traditions. If you get 50 years from now, a whole group of people who are top of the building witnesses to reaction to the fall of the towers, then you will have a parallel to the Christian movement. I don't think that 20 years from now there's going to be a whole group of people saying, see, that Trump, he really saw the truth.
You know, it's so hard to tell, you know, and it makes me kind of sad, only because, you know, I think about other things like the continued belief that many people hold that the claim that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was true, or that the even older than that, that the sun revolves around the earth rather than the other way around. And so the sticking around of these beliefs, it seems impossible to analyze it in a way that, when confronted with evidence, that it seems irrelevant in this case. And I think one of the best ways that you expressed this is when you were talking about Jesus himself, and you were talking a little bit about the Jeffersonian view of Jesus and who Jesus was and his and Jefferson's effort to remove many of the supernatural claims from the Bible. And what you had written was that the only Jesus we have is the Jesus of faith. If you reject the faith, there is no reason to trust anything the Gospels say. And I agree with that on the one hand. On the other hand, it makes it so difficult to know what to do, because if the requirement is belief from the outset, then it seems impossible to ever challenge that core belief.
Well, it's a matter, I suppose, of, is the only test of reality the scientific experimental test, or is it, what's your feel of what is deepest in the human personality, in human relationships, all those things that come with reflection and experience and humanity. And you can't set down a series of logical reasonings that tell you, for instance, that nothing's more important in life than love. That's something that you have to apprehend outside the laboratory.
Right. And I think that the end point is that people can come at that from different perspectives, either from a theistic belief or not. And, you know, I think that's part of why Pope Francis seems to be such a transformative figure, particularly for the Catholic Church, because he is trying to include everybody into the fold. And that seems to me to be quite a great thing. I have to imagine that about 5 years ago or so, perhaps a little bit longer, 10 years ago, let's say, that you probably never imagined that a pope like Francis would be the pope.
No, so, that's not true, because I thought that exactly about John the 23rd. That was he was the Francis of his day, and that was more my day. So we did have a miraculous pope already.
Yeah. Yeah. And with Pope Francis, what do you think are going to be the changes that we'll begin to see based on what you're seeing so far?
Well, it depends on us. You know, as he says himself, I can't do it. It's how much those of us responding try to live the way he's leading the way, like Jesus.
And that's it for today's Equal Time for Free Thought. If you missed any part of this program or wanted to share with friends, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. And remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.